Hey everybody, I have got some great news. Improv team submissions for the 6th annual Steel Stacks Improv Comedy Festival are now open at steelstacks.org/improv. Now, I had the chance to perform and record an episode of Improv Nerd at the festival way back in 2015, and I gotta tell you, I had a great time. It's a wonderful improv community and an amazing venue. This year's festival is January 25th and 26th in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and this year's marathon-style festival will feature a performance from Off Book, the improvised musical podcast with Zach Reino and Jessica McKenna. You can learn more and submit your team at steelstacks.org/improv. Now, the early bird submissions are open until October 20th, so hurry, 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 and the submission deadline is November 7th. That's steelstacks.org/improv. If you are new to improv or you're a seasoned improviser looking for a new approach to your scenic improv, I want to tell you about my Artist Low Comedy Level 1 Fundamentals of Improv starting October 31st here in Chicago at Green Shirt Studio. It's based on before you can be funny, you need to be real. And guess what? You're going to be even funnier. It's about taking the pressure off yourself to come up with witty and clever dialogue, because in the Artist Low Comedy, you'll learn to slow it down and tap into your life experience so that dialogue just comes out naturally. You'll learn that everything you need from your partner comes from your partner and not in your head. It will make improv as easy as having a conversation. I limit this to 14 people so you get personal attention. For more information, go to my website, JimmyCorain.com. That's JimmyCorain.com.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Ike Barinholtz. He studied improv in the 90s in Chicago at Second City, I.O., and The Annoyance. He was on Mad TV for 5 seasons, and he was a writer, producer, and actor on The Mindy Project. He is also now the writer, director, and star of his new dark comedy, The Oath. We sat down with Ike in Chicago and talked to him about what he was like when he first started out doing improv, how he got through the lean years between Mad TV and The Mindy Project, and why it was so important for him to do the movie The Oath. And before we get to the interview with Ike, I just want to say, I want to let everybody know this. I think I'm doing a pretty good job as a dad, which surprises me. Betsy gets scared a lot of the times, which is great that she goes, oh, I'm scared of the carousel, or she'll say, I'm scared of the balloons, or she's scared of beards. She's terrified of Santa Claus or pictures of Santa Claus or anyone who has a white beard. So the other day I had her up on the changing table and she was talking about she's now in preschool. And let me tell you something, dropping Betsy off at preschool is still very emotional for me. It's the second week, and she only goes 2 days a week. But I just leave there. I just feel really emotional. So one of the fathers in the room is very tall, and he has a white beard, just like Santa Claus. And when he comes in and drops off his daughter, Betsy gets very afraid. So I stay there, and I usually hold her hand for a couple minutes until he leaves and the other parents leave. So that night, I had her on the changing table because I was changing one of her stinky poopies. We have a little game, you know, like, oh, Betsy, Daddy's going to change one of your stinky poopies. And she wanted me to hold her hand because she was scared. And she said, and I said, Betsy, I hold your hand because you're scared. And she goes, yes, when you hold my hand, I feel better. And I felt at that point, my job as a father was done. I mean, I can't tell you how proud I was, not only of my daughter, but of myself. So it gives me confidence that maybe I won't screw Betsy up as much as I was screwed up as a kid. Let's only hope. That's not much hope, is it really? But for me, it truly, truly is. Our guest today, Ike Barinholtz, a Chicagoan, a guy that is just sincerely nice and kind and hardworking and very talented. And he shares, I hope, with you some of the secrets of his success in this interview. So here it is, the Ike Barinholtz episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Ike Barinholtz, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Do you remember the last time we were on?
Yeah.
Where were we?
We were at, was it Harry
Carey's?
It was your dad, your brother, and just the noisiest restaurant.
The noisiest restaurant in Chicago. But here we are in the Athletic Club.
Right, and you're in town to promote your film, The Oath.
Yes, sir.
Which you wrote and directed.
Yes, sir.
And before we get into the movie, your dad has a very small part in it. And I just want to say, no one is more proud of you and your brother, John, who's also in the movie, in your careers, than your dad. What was it like? Because he was an actor turned lawyer. What was it like giving him a part in the movie?
Yeah, well, first of all, he was so excited. And he was so cute about it because he didn't want to be too excited. He was like, "Sure, let me know whatever you need." And one day, I you know, he sent me. His part is all audio on the phone. He plays my attorney. What a stretch.
Sheldon
the attorney. And we needed him to record some extra material. And I called him. I said, "Hey, we have to do some stuff with your part." And he goes, "It's okay. I understand. You need to cut it." I was like, "God, he is still an actor. He's so ready for rejection."
Okay, so can you confirm the rumor he was not difficult to work with?
No, okay. I cannot confirm that.
Okay.
It was very difficult. Okay. I had a big problem, though.
Okay. Let's start with your improv career here in Chicago.
Yeah.
It's in the 90s. You're studying at Second City, Illinois.
Yes, sir.
And you said you weren't very good.
When I first started, I was not. Mm-hmm. I think very few people, because some people have like theater backgrounds and they're a little more, acclimated to being on stage. I was very cold. And when I first started, I wasn't very good. I was very, like a lot of young men, I think pretty aggro on stage, and all my characters were angry, and I would go blue very quickly. And it was really, a combination of like amazing teachers, like Craig Kukowski and Peter Gwynn, and God bless, rest in peace, Dell gave me some great notes, and then also watching the Tina Fey's and the Brian Stacks, and learning that there can be a lot of room for subtlety, and you don't have to come out and get that huge laugh right away, which I was always kind of chasing, and you can kind of let things kind of build and really appreciate the space and the silence. And so I really give credit to not just the teachers but the great performers that I grew up. You know what I mean? I would go and watch the Armando every single Monday for 2 years, every single Monday, and that really was like college for me, pretty much.
And what I always respected in your work is this confidence. Even on Man TV towards the end, where the material wasn't that good.
It was not that good.
You still go out there with confidence.
Yeah.
How did you develop that? Because that's something I would love to have more.
I don't know. I think I grew up in this very humorous home, and I think, there's a looseness with that and kind of the ability to make fun of myself and laugh at myself. I never really was one of those people, if you made fun of me, I'd get really mad. You know what I mean? I'd kind of like laugh at it and play along with it. So I think that kind of, attitude combined with, as you know, when you teach, you tell your students, embrace the fear. McNapier, embrace the fear. You know what I mean? You're going to be bad. You're going to be bad. That's fine. It's okay if you're bad. And that kind of freedom to go on stage and not care if, obviously you still care a little bit, but not worry so much. It allowed me to really kind of get up there and kind of stand behind the material, even if I truly didn't. You know what I mean?
How did you get over when you get a script and you're like, oh, this is crap. I don't want to do this.
Well, I think part of the Chicago in me is I always do respect my boss, which is a big thing. I think, whether it was on Mad TV, even though towards the end I was kind of, a pain in the ass. But whenever I would get something, I would just look at it and, try my best before we shot it to make it as funny as I could. And then, there's nothing worse than watching someone bail. Like, when you watch someone in a bad scene, it's bad. But when you watch someone in a bad scene and they start bailing, it makes you question the whole form. It makes you question the whole, what are we doing? So I never wanted to be that guy, the guy who just wears it on his face that he's not happy and he's over it. I to me, that's just a wasted opportunity.
So from 2002 to 2007, you're on Mad TV after doing Boom Chicago.
Yep.
And then you decide you're going to leave the show.
Yep.
And you just said, you know, you were kind of difficult at the end.
Yeah.
Was that a hard decision? How did you make that decision to leave?
They made it for me.
Okay.
My contract was up, and I remember, I'll never forget, I said to my wife, I said, if they want me back for that sixth season, they're going to have to pay me. And they didn't. They were like, we're streamlining the show, and we're cutting people, and you would be too expensive because you have years here. And so they made a difficult decision a lot easier. If you don't have an offer, you can't pass it. Mm-hmm. So I was confident still. I was like, okay, well, I'm ready to do my own sitcom now because that's how it works. And then I found out I had a couple, maybe 3.5 more years in the darkness of trying to find myself and trying to find my voice.
And what did you do? Because I heard people like, you and Dave Statson were writing.
Yes.
You were like getting to work. You weren't a guy who was sitting there waiting for the phone to ring.
I couldn't because it was so not ringing. And I did come out to LA to write. My best friend Dave, we went to high school together here, and we're like, let's write. And so we recommitted to it. And after writing a few horrible scripts, we finally wrote one that sold. And that changed everything because I was like, okay, I can make a little bit of money out here as a writer, and that'll be my new existence. And I still had another year and a half of not getting any real acting love, and it wasn't until Danny McBride kind of plopped me on Eastbound and Down where I all of a sudden had a little bit of validation, and I was able, that opened up some more doors.
How do you keep the faith during that period?
That's tough, man. That's a tough one. I mean, I was lucky that I had my wife who was working, and so we didn't have to worry about not eating. My parents, as you know, are so supportive.
Oh,
they're just the most supportive people. And when times were tough, and I would call them, and I'd be crying, because I would get so close to so many things, and then they would say no. So it was really hard. But I you have to have a little bit of, feeling sorry for yourself time. But then, you think like Chicagoans, they get hit sometimes, and you got to get back up. You got to get up. And so to say to myself, I'm just going to write. I'm going to write my way out of this. That was really what I leaned on.
And then you get the Mindy Project.
Yeah.
And when you look back at that, I mean, what is a fond memory of that show, of that time?
I mean, she did so much for me, Mindy Kaling. I mean, she really took me and said, you're funny and you're a good writer and I'm going to hire you guys as writers and maybe you'll be on the show.
You and Dave.
Me and Dave. And that first kind of summer where we were writing the show, I'll really look at that as boot camp kind of, because I'd never really been in a real network comedy room before. So in the first 2 years were so hard. We were on Fox and they didn't really like us, and you're worrying about ratings, and every Wednesday you're looking to see what the numbers are. But amidst that chaos, I learned so much. I learned how to produce. I learned when you write an episode of a show Mindy Kaling's producing, you are producing that episode. You're on set, you're at the concept meetings, you're in editing. She really, really gives you the power to do it, and I fell in love with it. And my favorite memories are the long nights where we would just be ordering food and laughing and playing games. But I really look at that as if it wasn't for her, there is 0.0 chance I would be here right now with you. And I just, I'm so grateful to her.
And the thing that I've always found interesting to you is you originally wanted to be a politician.
Yeah.
So I would imagine having those skills, because everybody that I know in your orbit out there in L.A., they love Ike. I love Ike. You're always very personal, always very nice. How much is that, do you need to put that into producing?
I think a lot. It is being a politician, isn't it? It is knowing how to talk to people and having to negotiate and having to, you really want to get this shot, but your first AD says, hey, man, we don't have the time for it, and you have to go and you have to smooth things over with the actor that you promised you were going to get that. So
I bet you are great at that.
I am. That is the thing I excel at the most, is communication and kind of positivity. Even when I get annoyed on set or I'm mad at something, you can get mad, but if you talk to people and you treat them with respect and you make them feel like they truly are part of the team, they're going to work really hard for you. And that is, again, something that I did learn from, the Danny McBrides and the Mindy Kalings, is really you got to communicate.
So let's talk about your new movie, The Oath, which I saw was great.
Oh, thank you, Jim. Thank you, man.
It's a dark comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm watching this. I have all these theories why you wanted to write this. So before we go into that, tell the audience a little about the movie.
So the movie is about a family living in a very politically divided America, if you can imagine such a thing.
Fiction or nonfiction?
It's basically sci-fi.
Okay.
There's a deadline to sign this, not mandated, but almost compulsory loyalty oath that the crazy president, who's not Trump, is putting out there. And the deadline is the Friday after Thanksgiving. So it's all about that week of Thanksgiving, that we all know that week. You're at home and your brother's coming in and he's very differently political than you. And so it's all about this. The first half of the movie is this, you know, the pressure cooker of being in that family during family home during the week of Thanksgiving. And then, as you know, it starts to take a turn, and we go into a crazy place where the bad guys do come to the door, and we do see what government overreach looks like, and it does kind of turn into this almost desperate hours-y type of
It's scary.
It's scary, yeah. I think, you know, I really, in terms of the tone, I knew that it had to be a complex tone, because if you make this movie, a movie about, you know, how politics is reflected onto an American family now, and you just made it a pure comedy, I think people would say, well, I'm not connecting with that, because you're not taking into account the seriousness and what's happening in the country. And on the flip side, if you made it just a thriller, a dramatic thriller, people would be like, it's too heavy, and you're missing out the fun parts of it. So I really tried my best to kind of walk that line and take the audience on a bit of a roller coaster.
Was it a reaction to what's going on? Was it because you were a father? These are all my theories.
100%.
Okay.
Yeah, it was. I mean, first of all, there's no chance this movie was made if Hillary Clinton won. It just wouldn't happen. It was the Thanksgiving after the election. After dinner, my mom and my brother and I got in this big fight, and we're yelling at each other, it's your fault. I woke up the next morning, I said to my wife, holy shit, we're on the same fucking side. We voted for the same person. And I thought, if this is happening here, what's happening at other tables? And I talked to my family, and I talked to my friends, and I knew that the landscape of the American holiday table has changed forever, and I really wanted to blow it up.
And in this movie talks about polarization in this country, and I'm thinking myself, is there any hope for this to change?
Yes, and that's why, not to give anything away, I did want to end the movie on an optimistic note, because, and I understand this is coming from a place of privilege, I am optimistic about America, and I know for a lot of people right now they're hurting in unimaginable ways, but I do believe in this country, and I believe it is bigger than Trump, and it's bigger than Mitch McConnell, and it's bigger than any politician, and, you know, I think you're seeing a generation right now of young kids who, when I look on Twitter or online, and I see 16-year-olds who are saying things like, I can't wait to vote, it gets you emotional.
Well, you do not hold back on Twitter.
No, I know, much to the chagrin.
Do you get any crap?
Yeah, you know, at first when I would tweet stuff, I would get a lot of people who would write back, like, stick to comedy, you know, don't tell me what to do. And I understand, I know there's a lot of people who are in media or who are actors and stuff, and they do kind of internalize it, and they don't want to stay neutral. But we are living in such unneutral times that, to me, it's impossible, for at least for me, to pretend to be, you know, Sweden here. I feel like we, you know, really are, you know, sides are being drawn, and I'm trying to, you know, get people who might be on this other side to kind of wake up a little bit and say, okay, yeah, that guy is a hypocrite. And on the same side, point out to some of the people on my side that we are not perfect. And we make mistakes too.
And you do a great job of that in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, this Thank guy you. Does not listen to anybody else's opinion.
He's a dick.
Right. So how much is, because you're a very gracious person, a good listener, stuff like that. How much is him in you?
Quite a bit. Less now than a year and a half ago. I was.
What changed?
I basically did a little self-help. And
what'd you do?
I unplugged a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I try, you know, I try to understand that there is change that we can affect, right? You can give money to a candidate you like, you can vote, make people you know vote. But at the end of the day, a lot of this stuff is going to happen whether or not, whatever you do. And I thought to myself, why should I focus exclusively almost on these things that I hate or I'm in trouble by, when I can still be in tune with what's happening in our culture and our society, but also embrace and look for joy in the things that I love? And I think it is trying to find that balance. You don't want to unplug, and you can't be one of these people who's like, eh, I don't watch the news, because then you're not doing any civic duty.
Were you like your character in
yes.
the movie where I'm checking my thing, who's doing this, I gotta go back and watch CNN?
Yes. obsessively.
And how did your wife react to that?
Terribly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I was just like in the movie, I was wearing her down. And I'll never forget, there was one morning where it was like 6:25 a.m. and we're in bed and she's breastfeeding our newborn. And I'm reading some godforsaken article about what something the president's done. And I turn to her very morose and I say, America's lost. And she was like, hey, dude. Too early, too heavy, too early, and I was making her crazy. And I was the guy that when you would go have beers with your friends, the first thing, can you believe what's happening? This guy's a fucking fascist. Holy shit. And I realized that if you're only talking about that and you're always at a 10, people will tune out. And people who otherwise might be acclimated to say, yeah, you're right, might be like, oh, enough already. So I try my best to stay informed and stay angry and fight, but also not let it completely dominate my thoughts.
And also, when I watched this movie, when it was over, I'm thinking to myself, this is a big risk for you. Because I'm sure after Neighbors and Sisters, you could do any fun comedy. You wrote and directed this. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if your management was like, come on, Ike, let's just do something fun here. Let's get your name out. Was this...
Guys, I gotta say, they were so supportive. Because they know, I've been with them forever, my team. And they know. They see my tweets and they, you know, laugh at them and are disturbed by them, I'm sure. But I told them, hey, this is what I wanted to do. And we knew I wanted to write and direct and star in a comedy. And they were so supportive. And they right away identified, oh, these producers who did Get Out, this is the perfect thing for them. So they were the ones who really put me in touch with those guys, and they gave me a full throat support. Yeah, it was good. Thank God.
Also, to comedy today, there's so many issues, and it's polarized comedy in a way. Is that going to change? And how do you handle that? How do you handle that? Walking that line, it seems everything changes every couple weeks.
I think for, you know, to me, it's a good question. To me, as long as you're not like a bad guy, for lack of a better word, you're going to be able to survive. You know what I mean? In terms of like actual comedy, and this falls a little bit more in the stand-up, arena. But I know I do talk to some people who are like, "What's funny anymore?" It's like there's a million things that are funny. Things that might not be funny or kind of a bad area to go in now, that those doors have closed a little bit, but other doors have opened, and it is cyclical, and things that we thought were hilarious 20 years ago aren't. So to me, I'm not one of these people who say, oh, comedy's, you know, dead and nothing's funny anymore. And I think people who kind of say that, I think they're looking at themselves in the mirror and they're trying to figure out how they can evolve. And some people do it with grace and knock it out of the park, and then some people are just kind of trapped in their old mindset and they're reluctant to accept the new America.
And what do you hope after people watch this movie, what happens in their lives?
The first and foremost thing is that it's not a documentary yet.
Okay.
But I hope they're entertained. I hope they go and they laugh and they feel those emotions. But at the same time, the message of the movie really is, we have an obligation as not just Americans, but as husbands and fathers and daughters and sisters, to at least try to not let these external forces that we ultimately can't fully control, not let them permanently sever our relationships. Because like I said, there will be a day where there's a president in this country not named Trump, I think. And if there is, I feel like people will kind of look back and be like, I wish I never severed that tie. So, because it's hard to reattach it. And so my hope is that they walk out and they're entertained, but they think, I'm going to take it easy on my brother this year. That's what I'm really hoping. I want to burst some bubbles here.
We got to wrap this up, but two really quick questions. Yes, if you ran for president.
Yeah. Ooh.
Okay. What would be on your platform? What are the three issues?
The three biggest issues. I'll give you two serious ones and a joke one. One, I would try our best to fix the immigration problem and really remember that we are a country built by immigrants, and the fact that we're closing our doors to refugees and people who need America and can contribute so much to America, the fact that they can't get in is disgusting. So I really would try to, you know, get our borders in good shape. I would try our best. I think America leads by example. And I think in, you know, 15 years, the air and the water will be shit. And we were leaving it to China to do it. And we need to lead on that. And then this is the most serious one. Anyone who says deep dish pizza is not real pizza, I will reopen Guantanamo Bay, and they will be sent there. And whatever happens is on them.
All right. We always end the podcast the same way, and that is, what is one piece of advice you would give an improviser starting out today?
Whew. Be honest. Be honest with yourself. Be honest. You know, I'm not saying go up to your team afterwards and be like, hey, you guys suck tonight. But be true to yourself. And I know that sounds a little cheesy, but the things that make you laugh and the things that inspire you and you think are interesting, that's your job to educate the audience and to get them into your mindset and to show them that.
And to get to the point where you said the part when you lost the job on Mad TV,
yeah,
until 3.5 years.
Yes.
You said you found your voice.
Yeah.
How much is pain involved in finding your voice?
So much. Anyone that has not been through pain and has a voice is like the luckiest person in the world. And we take these experiences, these negative experiences, and the rejection and the pain we feel, and we weave it into this tapestry of who we are, and embrace it, and don't let it dominate you, and take a little bit of Chicago mindset. You get hit in the face, you get back up, and you keep walking.
Ike Barinholtz, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Always a pleasure, Jimmy.
It's always a pleasure to see you, and thanks for doing this.
Yeah,
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Ike Barinholtz. Check out his movie, The Oath, at a theater near you. Also, I would like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice. Also, Sam Bowers, the director of Improv Nerd, for recording this episode. For more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning Artist Low Comedy classes, workshops, and intensives, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, _nerd. Like our Facebook page, Improv Nerd, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Sign up for our YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, where you'll see video clips from our live interviews and shows. Also, if you're an improv teacher and you want to get better at teaching, check out our Patreon page at Improv Nerd. We have a masterclass video lessons. It's only $10 a month, so go to Patreon and check that out. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Nerd is a nerd.